RNZ National, and it's time now for The Rest is History, where we look at the week's news in the past. And tonight we're looking at the history of the National Party. Following a resounding defeat by Labour in the 1935 general election, with Michael Joseph Savage becoming the first Labour Prime Minister, the remnants of the United Reform Coalition government met in Wellington on the 13th to the 14th of May 1936, the following year, to establish a new anti-socialist party. Well, political scientist, historian and political biographer, and a man who stood for election for both National and Labour, Dr. Barry Gustafson joins us. Good evening, Barry.
Good evening, Karen.
Take us back to this day in 1936. I know you weren't there, but who was at the meeting?
Well, there were, as you say, it was the remnants of the Liberals, who were renamed for a brief time United, the Liberal Party and the Reform Party that had governed New Zealand from 1890. So they had been in government, the Liberals from 1890 to 1912, the Reform Party from 1912 to 1928, and then the United was formed out of the remnants almost of the Liberal Party, and then with the Depression, they came together to form a coalition national government, which was defeated at the 1935 election, as you mentioned. And the remnants of those parties, United, Liberal and Reform, decided they'd form a new party called the National Party. But it was very difficult. I mean, these were the parties that opposed each other for 60 years. Their leaders detested each other. Coates on the Reform side, Forbes on the Liberal United side. And it was always going to be an alliance, but the main thing that held them together was their dislike of socialism and the new trade union-backed Labour Party that had come to office. And so that was the thing that bound them together. But they still represented quite different sectional interests and ideological interests in New Zealand. And to be quite honest, those factions within the National Party, when it was created, have gone through right to the present day.
Well, where was this meeting held?
It was held in Wellington on the 13th and 14th of May. There were MPs there, but there were also people who had been involved in the organisation of the Reform and the Liberal parties. But there was a lawyer called Hammond who largely wrote their constitution, which was a very, very sophisticated and clever document, far-seeing document, and Colonel Weston, who became their president. And what they were creating was a party that they thought could rival Labour. They looked at Labour and its sweeping election, and they thought, look, this is a party that has set up a branch structure throughout the country of activists. It is a party that has support from the trade union movement. It gets out and it relates to its voters on an ongoing basis. We need to create a party that can do the same, that can create a branch structure that can liaise with sectional groups like Federated Farmers and Manufacturers and Chambers of Commerce and build up a party structure that can compete with this new mass-based Labour Party. And they succeeded very well. They actually created a party that, per head of population, was probably the largest mass membership party, and I would argue perhaps the most successful mass membership party in the Western world.
Given their disparate views, it must have been a difficult few days.
Well, it was a very difficult few days, and one of the major problems, I mean, they could agree on a certain set of principles, and one principle was that we represent all New Zealanders. That's why they call themselves National. We're not a sectional party. We don't represent the trade unions or the farmers, which Reform did, or the urban business class, which the Liberal United Party did. We represent all Maori or women or men or whatever. We represent all New Zealanders, and we will try to devise policies and govern in the interests of all New Zealanders rather than one section. So that was one unifying thing. The second unifying thing was opposition to communism and socialism, which they regarded as virtually the same thing. They saw the end of socialism as being Soviet-style communism. So they were united by what they were opposed to as much as what they were saying we stand for. They also believed in the empire. They believed in tradition. They believed in the Western Alliance and the defence of New Zealand, things like that. Where they had a real problem was in sectional differences, because reform had represented largely the farming and rural interests, and United and Liberal had represented the business sector, and the business sector was divided between those who didn't mind a bit of intervention and legislation and regulation, and a very free market fringe, which resembles ACT in many ways, but was even critical of the United and Reform Party as being too socialist. So you had to tie these different groups together. But also the fact was that the most prominent politicians who were left in Parliament hated each other. Forbes and Coates, who were the two dominant people, really detested each other, and neither would accept the leadership of the party by the other one. So they had to find an alternative, and they ended up with an independent, basically, a reform-type independent man called Hamilton as their first leader. That they could agree on, and Coates and Forbes agreed on him. One other person who was considered at that early stage was a very young Keith Holyoake, who came from Motueka, and who actually had held his seat in 35 against the Labour swing, but was to lose it in 38. And the reformers, I think, if they couldn't get Coates, would have considered Holyoake. But there was no way. He was seen as a protege of Coates, so he was not acceptable to Forbes and the United people. And so they picked Hamilton, and from that way on, they had a leader, but not very successful. And in 1940, there was a coup which led to Sid Holland becoming the leader. And the United people wanted Holland in at that stage, because Holyoake was out of politics, didn't come back until 1943, and they wanted to cement the leadership, if you like, on the right of the party, the urban wing of the party, rather than let Holyoake come in and lead a rural-led party. One of the things about their leadership is, of course, that in order to keep your factions together, whenever you pick the leader from one side of the party, you tended to pick his deputy eventually from the other side. So with Holland, Holyoake becomes the leader. When Holyoake becomes the leader, you pick a deputy from the urban wing of the party, which is Sir John Marshall. And that goes on right through the history. When Muldoon becomes the leader from the urban side of the party, you pick Tallboys from the rural side of the party.
They were initially billed themselves as anti-socialist, but how else at that time in the 1930s, mid-1930s, did they differ from the Labour government?
Oh, they were very, very anti anything that Labour came up. They reminded me a little bit of the Republicans in America today. Anything that the Democrats and Biden suggest, we will oppose totally. And from 1935 until the outbreak of the war, that was what the National Party did. It its first 5 years in history, of its history, was basically opposing social security, opposing state housing, opposing anything that Labor did in setting up a health system or anything, the education system. But they started to realise, and I think Holland was very shrewd in this, they started to realise that you didn't get anywhere by just opposing. And so after 1938, when Labor actually increased its vote considerably, although it lost a couple of seats, National realised it had to stand for something, not just against something. And so Holland started to work out, we're going to stand for less regulation, lower taxes, less government, less interference in people's lives, a property-owning democracy. And that was consolidated by people like Marshall and Holyoake, who thought very strongly about these issues and came up with the National Party as the natural party of government, governing in the interests of all New Zealanders and creating a prosperous property-owning democracy, and using the state to regulate, but not in a heavy-handed way, but certainly in a what we call a corporate way. And the National Party for a long time did what Labor did. It tended to govern New Zealand through a coalition of interest groups at the top. So you had all kinds of meetings of trade unions and federated farmers and business sector meeting together and working out pragmatic compromises when it came to economic and social policy.
And you mentioned that their membership grew very quickly from the formation of the National Party in 1936. Yes. But it took them quite a few years before they actually won an election, didn't it?
Yes, it did. What they did was they had some superb organisers who were typified by a man called Tom Wilkes, who was a brilliant organiser. And Wilkes, of the 30s and 40s, travelled New Zealand with other organisers, and they literally visited, they'd visit a small town like Tikawiti or a town like Hamilton, and they'd visit every accountant and every lawyer and every businessman, and they'd talk to them and say, you know, we're trying to set up an organisation, would you be interested in becoming a member? Would you pay a membership fee? Would you be prepared to attend a meeting and become a branch secretary or chairman? And they created a network right across New Zealand. And at one stage, you know, even as late as Muldoon, the beginning of the Muldoon era, they had 100,000 plus members in New Zealand, which was a huge percentage of their vote. Far more than most political parties in the Western world had. And these members were given the task of not only raising money and campaigning and organising the vote, but picking the candidates. So, you know, for every 10 members, you could have a delegate at the selection meeting for a candidate. And you couldn't, they started off by saying, well, you can't pick a candidate unless you've got 1,000 members in a Labour-held seat and 2,000 members in a national-held seat. And when you get that membership up to there, then you can have a selection meeting and pick your candidate or endorse your existing MP. So there was an encouragement to raise the membership. And the party said right at the beginning in its constitution, the party will raise the money, the party will pick the candidate, the party locally, the party will conduct the campaign locally. Once the election's over and we have a parliamentary group, for the next 3 years, we won't tell them what to do. They'll have our policy planks, but they'll have to make their own decisions, how they implement them and what order, and if there's anything comes up that we haven't foreseen. We will not tell. We won't be like a trade union movement telling a Labour government what to do. We will stand aside and say, you make the decisions. You're the MPs. You're the government. But you don't tell us how to run our party and pick our candidates between elections.
That's changed, though, hasn't it?
Well, that is, I think, one of the big changes that has happened, and I think, to be quite honest, it's one of the weaknesses of the National Party today, that it has allowed itself to become centralised, largely dominated by its parliamentary party, as Labour has, of course. It's allowed its very strong divisional structure, which resembled, there were five divisions, the Auckland, Wellington, Hamilton, Waikato, Bay of Plenty, Christchurch and Otago Southland divisions. It's allowed those five divisions less and less autonomy. It's allowed the electorates and branch system to wither away. You now find if you select a National Party candidate, normally there's a couple of hundred members left in an electorate, and so the central office and the board pick a lot of the people who come in to vote for the candidate, so it's not solely a local candidate anymore. It's much more centralised, and instead of getting local notables, I mean, in the past, the National Party centrally might not like somebody, but they couldn't decide not to pick that person if the locals wanted the person. So a Marilyn Waring, who had the support of the locals, could be picked even though she was out of step with perhaps the parliamentary party for a long time or the leader. The National Party tried very hard, or certain members of the urban wing of the National Party, the free market urban wing, tried very hard during the 1940s to get Sir Leslie Munro into Parliament. They tried, for example, to push Sir Ron Algy aside in Remuera to get him in so they could get him as leader after Holland instead of Holyoake. The people in Remuera said, no, we don't want that. We're not prepared. And it took them a long while to finally get Munro in. And it was fairly clear that Holyoake had the support of the majority of the party inside and outside Parliament.
Barry, just going back to Adam Hamilton, he was elected as the first leader in 1936, and then Sidney Holland, as you said. Was it policy that got Sidney Holland into power for the National Party the first time, or personality, or was it the economic climate? We'd just come through the Second World War, obviously. Had the public just got tired of Labour?
Yeah, no, Hamilton was a competent man, but a fairly lacklustre leader, and his main qualification was that he hadn't been a strong person in the Reform Party leadership or the United Liberal leadership. So he's a compromised candidate, and he was an older man. And he was there basically until they sorted themselves out, I thought, and could get someone else. But the reform group of Coates and Massey, not Massey the Prime Minister, but Massey's son, who was the MP for Franklin, Coates and Massey and Hamilton and others, when the war came, they were fairly supportive of the Labour government's war effort. And Holland and others decided to oppose the Labour government, and particularly argued that it was soft on strikers and trade unions and mine workers and so on. And they left the war cabinet and walked out to become a total opposition outside the government, because Labour had set up a war, its own cabinet, which was doing domestic things, but a war cabinet to run the war. And Coates and Massey and the others on the more reform side, decided they would stay in the war cabinet and support the government in the war effort. And Holland and the others left and became a total opposition.
Well, Barry, the National Party is 85 years old today. In your opinion, is it still in strong shape?
Yes, it is. And in fact, I used to say this when National was very strong and Labour was divided among Labour, New Labour and the Greens, or the Alliance and the Greens. And I'd say, look, it's roughly 50% National and 50% Labour, but Labour's divided into three or four parties. And I look at the scene today, and you've got Labour and the Greens on one side, and you've got National and ACT on the other. And what you have is the National Party is represented, the National Party of 1935 is now represented by not one party in Parliament, but by two. The right-wing, if you like, laissez-faire ACT party, and the more traditional pragmatic centre National Party. And you add them together, and they're not that far behind Labour and the Greens in percentage terms, but they're not united like they were in 1936.
So if you had to stand for either today, who would you choose?
Oh, that's a very difficult one. I think to be quite honest, both of them have got to sell themselves between now and the next election. I don't think many people who thought strongly about National last year voted National with any sense of confidence or enthusiasm. They were shambles in every way. They were own worst enemy in personnel and in policy. Labour was able, actually, as it did in 1938, and with Savage, to win with a charismatic leader who seemed to personify good intentions and a belief that people mattered most, and his government in 38 or her government last year in 20 were going to do things that would benefit the majority of people, particularly those in lower income and in more vulnerable circumstances. And so I think we've now got to see whether Labour can deliver what Savage's Labour did in 35 and 38. If they do, they could be in power for as long, which was 14 years. If they can't, then they will go out as National took the Kirk Labour government out in, not the Kirk Labour government, the Nash Labour government in 1960 after 3 years of letting down its supporters.
Well, Barry, thank you very much. There's obviously a longer story than this, but we just scratched the surface of the birth of the National Party. So we thank you very much for your insight tonight.
Thank you very much, Ken.